You believe in Jesus?
Yes, I do.
Well, you're going to meet him.
You see what fun this is? It's going to get really exciting. I know what to do now. They've made it clear.
You warriors are good. Real good. The best.
This is the end of your rotten life, you motherfucking dope pusher.
We'd make one hell of a team, Snake.
The name's Plissken.
Hey everybody, and welcome to 42nd Street Forever, the official podcast of Grindhouse Cinema Database. I'm Pete Roberts, and I'm very happy to welcome back journalist Gigi Graham to the podcast. Hi, Gigi.
Hi, thanks so much for having me back.
It's great to talk to you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Happy December, everybody. We made it.
Yeah, we made it through December, too. So for this episode, we thought we'd go through our top five favorite films from December, which is our annual marathon of Grindhouse movies. And we'll kind of be taking turns. You know, I'll do one, then you'll do one, and go in it. Since you're the special guest, I thought you could start things off with your first pick.
Okay, my first pick of this year's December movies is Sweet Trash, released in 1970, directed by John Hayes. Mm-hmm. Why this particular film? It's a very unusual movie. The cold open involves a mafia that is run by supercomputer. And then we move into the story of an alcoholic longshoreman who is being chased by said mafia for gambling debts. This sounds like it should be a heist film or a crime thriller, and it kind of slides and shapeshifts into something that's more of a hangout movie. He's a perpetual, you know, his name is Michael Patrick Donovan, and he's just a simple Coney Island longshoreman, but he's not running from these men. He just wants them to go away. He's kind of forced into this action movie premise, and he'd rather be doing anything else, drinking, boozing, screwing, cricket, you know?
That's good. That sounds good. Yeah, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah, it's a very unusually mellow film. It has a lot of visual style to it. Yeah. The director, John Hayes, was actually an Oscar nominee back in the 50s.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
So he scattered kind of pieces of his own backstory all over the film because he's a New York boy, you know.
Yep.
He kind of came from a lower class background. So he knows like pimps, pushers, you know, poor dock workers.
All those nice people.
They could be. We're not going to shame. We're not going to assume just because people are poor.
No pimp shaming.
Yeah.
But that does sound good. That's the only one I didn't see on your list. I saw the other ones, but I just wasn't able to see it. But I'd really like to see this one because it sounds good.
There's a Vinegar Syndrome double disc that has it running with another John Hayes film called The Hang Up.
Yep.
I don't like The Hang Up as much. I feel Sweet Trash is the stronger of the two.
Okay.
We've got some fantastic old New York footage.
Does it have like 42nd Street and stuff? Or
It's not so much 42nd Street. It's downtown. It's Coney Island. It's the docks. Because of course this man's brilliant idea of running away from the mob is getting on the Q train and taking it to the end of the line.
That's pretty good.
But I mean, considering, he's kind of an alcoholic dock worker, he can kind of hide in plain sight. He's not the sort of person that people really notice.
He's not like, you know, wearing flashy clothes or anything.
He's kind of down and out and people kind of don't pay attention to him anyway. And maybe that's why he doesn't run super far, because he doesn't have to.
Right. That's a good little way to like get out of things, just, you know, fade into the crowd.
Fade into the background.
That's a good premise, but it sounds really good though. But what year was that from? 1970.
1970.
Okay. Sounds good to me.
If you kind of want a more mellow, it's not the sexploitation thriller the premise or the poster would advertise it as. It's not exactly the crime thriller the cold open makes it seem like. But if you're looking for kind of a weirdly artsy, like sex and sleazy hangout film, then this will probably be something you'll dig.
Sounds really good. You know, I was wondering, should we like put like spoilers just so we can go through these movies without like, we can just talk about the whole movie without
Yeah, but
cutting stuff off, because I mean, I feel like
everybody, you know, if you're listening to the podcast, this may get into spoilery territory. So if you haven't seen one of the films on either of our lists and you want to pause
it and
watch the movie, come back.
Yeah, that makes sense, because then we can kind of like go through it without like, because it's tough to like discuss like the whole movie or, you know, just the character, you know, what's going on without just like giving some spoilery stuff out there. So, but okay, so I'll do my number five. And it's The Farmer.
The American Dreamer. Five easy pieces. Easy Rider. Taxi Driver. Important and deeply personal films. Each in its own way has become a classic. Each told the story of people looking for their own piece of the American dream. The Farmer is a motion picture in this special tradition. It's a story of a man who takes a stand. A man who says no and means it. A man like Kyle Martin. All he wanted from life was his farm and a chance to make something of it. Maybe he wanted too much.
A one-man farm can't make money.
I just need more time.
You are a loser.
When they took away his land, the farmer didn't get mad. He got even. When they tried to burn him out, the farmer didn't get mad. He got even. But when they killed his best friend and attacked the woman he loved, the farmer became the Avenger. Columbia Pictures presents Gary Conway as The Farmer, an uncompromising explosion of total vengeance. The Farmer. He never gets mad. He gets even.
The American dreamer, sometimes a thinker, sometimes a schemer. Sometimes a child.
The Farmer.
Sometimes a wise man. Lonely soul.
From 1977, and it was directed by David Berlatsky. I don't think he's done anything too popular other than this one. I don't know. I don't think so, anyways. I checked out his past, you know, career, and I didn't really see anything. Maybe some like TV work or something. I don't know. But I've been wanting to see this movie for like 25 years. Like I think I first saw the trailer like in the 90s, and like ever since I've been wanting to see it, but it's not on DVD or Blu-ray yet. But I hear like a buzz that it might be coming out like next year or something like that. But the copy I watched was on a really bad, it was like, you know, bad
the
shape.
The copy that's available is in.
Yeah. It looks like it was taped off of TV on Betamax and that got damaged or something. And it was like.
It's like magnetic tape. Like, I don't even think it's a VHS quality print. It's pretty rough.
It is. It's really rough. So it's like that kind of like didn't help things. But, you know, I kind of like, you know, I watched the whole thing. Like I was able to see most of it, But the premise is it's set in 1946, like after World War II, and it stars Gary Conway as a veteran, and his name is Kyle Martin. And when we first meet him, he's on a train heading back home, and I think it's set in Georgia. I'm not exactly sure if that's the state it's in, but like where he's going to. But
well, you can't exactly see the background in most.
Yeah, it's tough to see like where he is, but
rural South.
It's something like that in the rural South, right? But so he's going back home like after on the train, and he in like one of the first scenes, like he gets into a confrontation with a racist redneck that's giving a black soldier a hard time because he's like, you know, referencing Shirley Temple and Bilbo Jangles Robinson or something like that. And then Kyle drops the best line of the film. He says, "You made two mistakes. One, you got up this morning, and two, you insulted Shirley Temple." And they
that
like
is
a huge
the single best line of the
yeah,
movie.
I love that.
I
that
have
line
that written down in my notes.
So I was like, I had to write that down just so I remembered exactly. Then they get into this huge fight and Kyle gets booted right off the train. So it's like, you know, he's like walking home through the fields and stuff. And that's like sort of how the movie starts. So it's like, that was a pretty cool start to the movie, you know, and it started off with a bang. So, and then he walks home and then to his farm, and his old friend, faithful friend Gumshoe, was waiting there. Gumshoe. I thought that was a funny name. Like, you know, this like old, like, you know, this old codger guy, Gumshoe.
I don't know if he's supposed to be a codger. I don't know if he's supposed to be super country. That's one of the things you couldn't really see because of the print.
Yeah, I kind of thought it was just like a farmhand.
Kind of walking like stooped and hunched, like he was supposed to be older.
I think he was just like I think he was like his farmhand from like, you know, years before, like, you know, before he left for the war or something. And he was just kind of like hanging around the, you know, the place or something. I'm not exactly sure, but Kyle returns to the farm, and then like one night a guy crashes his car near the farm, and Kyle goes out and helps him. And it turns out this guy is like a crime guy, like a criminal guy from like the city. And he's like, you know, and Kyle like saves his life. So they kind of like have like a little friendship, and Kyle, like, you know, to pay him back, the gangster guy gives him some money. Like, I think he gives him like $1,500, and Kyle's trying to save his farm. So he uses that to pay for some of it, but then he finds out like it's worth, he has to pay like $50,000 to actually save the whole farm. And then, so then he's in trouble. And then, so then there's this whole like other plot about Johnny O's, like, you know, he's in trouble with these other gangsters. And one of the head gangster is played by George Mamoli. And if you know like the movie Mean Streets and Phantom of the Paradise, you'll know him from those movies. He plays like the head bad guy. And he's like out to get Johnny O for some bad bet that he didn't pay back or something. And so that's another part of the story. So then, like, you know, Kyle gets hooked up into this, like, you know, this problem that Johnny O is having, and, you know, everything kind of goes bad. And like, you know, so then, you know, he goes out to get revenge and that type of stuff. And it's just like this whole, but it's sort of reminded me of like Rolling Thunder and like those types of movies, Walking Tall. It has like sort of those types of, you know, that those types of
the thing,
you know,
I find interesting about this you know, vigilantes and kind of, you know, lone wolf movies were very trendy at the time, because this came out in 77. Yeah.
Right. Like Taxi Driver. It has, you know, it has a little bit of all that stuff in there, like a little bit of that.
But this went with, usually it's a Vietnam vet. They go with the contemporaneous. And I thought it was interesting that this was a period piece and it was set in World War II. Through the back half of the film, that becomes less apparent. They kind of forget about it. Like, the characters are still in period costumes, but they're not necessarily making period references or speaking in ways that would make sense for, you know, post-World
War II. Those people from like the 40s. Yeah, it doesn't seem so much 40s when you're watching it either.
Yeah, the first sort of like half modern. Is really meant to be, and then they kind of forget about it.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. And but you know, it does have like that type, it's like a Southern fried crime thrill, and it's sort of like, you know, half like, you know, rural, half in the city type stuff. And I just
the classic conflict of a lot of like drive-in and exploitation is, you know, these city interlopers in rural communities.
Right.
And go horribly,
that's pretty
wrong.
Cool. Yeah, that's what I really liked about it, though. And then also, like, maybe like movies like Exterminator, like it's sort of like that has like a sort of a similar story. Like, you know, they come back from Vietnam. It's basically like you were saying, it's like sort of like the World War II is just sort of a substitute for Vietnam in a way. You know what I mean? If it was, it could easily just be a Vietnam movie.
Really,
like,
you know, I wish they had committed to the period.
Yeah. Make it more like,
because I thought it was super interesting and something very different from what everybody else was doing that was making these kinds of films at the time.
But I'm really looking forward to like seeing like a really nice clean print of it too, because I think
because
that'll
there are
really
several like
notice things
and scenes that were kind of hard to parse.
Yeah, like I like especially like the revenge stuff at the end, like I could see it pretty good, but then, you know, it's like, you know, it was pretty tough to like see like exactly what was happening. Like he was kind of running around in the city, like, you know,
Into every life a little potato quality must fall. And I mean, hopefully this gets pulled out to at least, you know, could I at least get a 720p?
Yeah. No, this was like minus 120p or something.
Yeah, this was straight up
whatever. It was like substandard stuff. But I mean, you know, but I guess when it was released in grindhouses, it also went by the title Killer Farmer. And I was just trying to do some research on that, and I just found that out recently. That's what it, because I had seen you know, like how I do the like I was going to do the what was playing on the Deuce, those little posts I do on the Twitter. Like I one of the titles was Killer Farmer. I was like, I wonder if that's The Farmer or if it's like just some other separate movie. But I guess it is. That's what it went by, because especially like on the Deuce, like if you go see a movie there and it's called The Farmer, it's kind of sounds kind of dull. But then you add Killer to it, and it's like everything's
a bit of a stretch.
Yeah,
you know, like I'm sure once they sat down and the, you know, the booth had their ticket money, they were probably pissed.
Yeah, they just, you know, it just didn't do as well. So they added the killer to it, like Master Killer or whatever, you know, whatever other movie would be. But but I really like this one. So and I wanted to put it on this list just to kind of like give it a little boost too, you know, to
hopefully somebody finds a better existing print.
Yeah.
Good luck. Godspeed. We can hope.
I think someone said that a certain label has it, but they're like, wait, there's some, they're like they're holding on to it for some reason, or they're just not, you know,
rights issue.
Yeah. The rights thing or whatever.
Also, I'm pretty sure there were a couple of pieces of actual pop music in it, and that tends to hang things up. Sometimes.
Sarah, I don't even remember, but yeah, that's another little probably detail that keeps it hung up on the thing. But I guess, Gary Conway, the star of the movie, he starred in like several Western TV shows when he was younger, like in the '60s. And then he also wrote, which I didn't know, he wrote Over the Top, the Sylvester Stallone movie.
Oh, the arm wrestling movie.
Yeah. That arm wrestling movie. And he wrote American Ninja too. So that's kind of interesting to know that little bit of detail. I haven't seen Over the Top in years. I mean, it's kind of a corny movie, but
it's very silly.
Yeah, it is. It's goofy.
It's kind of fun. If you shut your brain off, it's fun.
Yeah. It's like, you know, when I was like 12, I liked it. But now, like, you know, I find it kind
of. Yeah, it's the sort of thing that would be awesome when you're 12.
Yeah, definitely. But okay, so that's my number five pick.
Okay, we're going to go next on the list. I actually didn't rank these. I just put them in the order that I pulled them off of my list.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I have to say, like, when it comes to, like, ranking the movies, it's like I always try to stay away from that because, like, I just feel like ranking movies is sort of like, if I like a movie, I like it and I don't care. You know, these are more like just the best ones, ones I like the most.
Yeah, it's instead of trying to my favorites.
So if they're not, like, you know, it doesn't, you can just take them in any order you want. But I mean, we like these movies a lot. So that's basically the main thing on this list, you know.
So next up, in no particular order, is Passport to Shame, alternately titled Room 43. It's a 1958 film from future BAFTA nominee. I'm not sure if he won, Alvin Rockoff.
Oh yeah.
This one is interesting to me because it has your standard Vice picture plot. We've got a square up at the beginning from Fabian of the Yard, who was a Scotland Yard inspector who got his own TV show. So, you know, we have the lawman explaining to us that the movie we're about to see is a hard-hitting expose of prostitution in London, which of course it's not. But for censorship reasons, that was a common thing to include.
Right.
And we've got your standard Vice picture plot, you know, slightly more complicated. A French waitress gets into some trouble at her job. She takes an offer of help from a wealthy English tourist. And the whole thing is, of course, a cover for a prostitution ring for a vice racket. She ends up in over her head. There's a whole complex subplot with a green card wedding. And
a green card wedding, yeah, I know.
And a whole, like, mansion full of prostitutes. And basically, in an overly elaborate bunch of machinations, it's up to the cabbie who married her for a green card to save her from the clutches of vice.
And was it Eddie Constantine? Is that who the
Eddie Constantine actor? Is our principal character. He is Johnny the cab driver. He was actually an American actor, but he primarily was famous in France.
Yeah, I read up on that. I was wondering, like, what his deal was, like, because I watched the movie and I was like wondering, like, what his, like, you know, what if I had seen any other movies with him, and I couldn't.
No, because
he didn't do a ton of
primarily work. Most of his work was in France. They like,
yeah, that's interesting.
Cast him as like a working class stiff, a bit of a tough guy. He's playing to type here.
Yeah.
Just and he's playing to general type here.
And then it also has Diana Dors, who I call the British Mamie Van Doren.
She's kind of the British Jane Mansfield, but definitely there.
She reminds me of more of Mamie, but yeah. She was good.
She was a bit taller. She had a rounder face, like the baby face, but she's never looked better than she does in this film. She's the prerequisite, you know, tart with a heart, hooker with a heart.
Right. That's what I was going to say. She's like, you know, she's like super hooker, like, but then she's like, you know, then she has like, you can see that she's like, you know, she has a heart too. And she's not like totally like hardcore.
And your principal villain, you know,
Herbert Lom
is Herbert Lom, who was in 99 Women, who was in The Dead Zone.
I know him from the Pink Panther. I know him best from the Pink Panther movies. That's where I first saw him. Did you ever see the movie Gambit? That's another good one with him.
I have not seen that.
That's one I'd recommend. I think you'd like that one with Michael Caine and what's her name? Can't think of her name. Shirley MacLaine.
Michael Caine is actually in Passport to Shame for like 2.5 seconds.
You know what? I was watching the movie and I'm like, is that Michael Caine? And I couldn't tell if it was him.
Young. He doesn't
have in that little crowd of people, right?
Yeah, outside the courthouse.
Yes. I was like, is that Mike? I thought like what it was like a guy that looked like Michael Caine. And I was like, is that him? I couldn't really tell, but I caught that too. Yeah. That was cool. So that's one of his earliest movies.
Yes. He's uncredited. He's baby faced, which is odd to look at.
That's pretty funny. Yeah.
We used him as a distinguished older gentleman.
Oh, yeah. And I'm trying to think what. Yeah, I had watched this movie before. I had watched this. I think it was from someone's list. I don't know if it was Martin Scorsese's list or like Edgar Wright or something. Was it? I don't know. It was on one of those lists that they did months ago, like last year or something. But I think that's where I first got the idea from. But to watch it. I thought it was really good.
On the edge of an exploitation film and like a noir.
That's right. It's like a British noir.
Yeah, it's definitely.
I really liked it.
And shot in a very noirish way.
Yeah.
It's got a ton of style to it. The opening shot to kind of set up that we're in a seedy neighborhood and there's a lot of double dealing that goes on is really gorgeous.
Yeah, I really liked this one a lot. It was excellent. Especially right up to the end of the movie, like you're like sitting on the edge of your seat type thing, you know?
As silly as the plot is, because I mean, any criminal operation that requires like four international branches and green card weddings and like two mansions is probably not going to stay operational for very long.
if you actually
think about the machinations of the plot, they fall apart pretty quickly.
And Herbert Lom was such a bastard in the movie, though, too.
He was such a bastard.
Oh my God.
In a camel hair coat. You know, he was
by the end, you're like, you know, like rooting for him to like, you know, see his demise or something. Yes. I mean, it's just, you know,
when he finally does receive his just desserts,
it's awesome. Earned. Yeah, that was a really good one. That was an excellent little thriller, like little crime. Yeah,
like it's a crime thriller dressed up like a Vice picture, shot like a noir.
Yeah, he's got excellent.
A better than average at cast skill wise.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, definitely. For sure, I feel like, weirdly enough, considering how dark a lot of the subject matter is, this is also a very sweet film. Like, there's a
lot especially with Malou. With Malou, and I think our name was Malou, right? Malou, and Malou. The French girl. French and then, they have that little those little parts where, like, they're in that little cozy little apartment, like, and stuff.
Yeah, and they're kind having coffee, and it's actually very sweet.
That's what I thought too. And like, you know, it was sort of like a nice little departure from like all the, you know, all the seedy, you know, crime stuff that's going on. They have kind of like a little like, you know, break.
Yeah, they're kind of each other's little oasis of like sunshine in like a very.
And you're hoping that like, you know, everything works out for them. And then all of a sudden, like, you know, that of course that doesn't, like, you know, something goes wrong and like, you know,
yes, of course.
First back into the
required, you know,
Herbert Lom won't let them get away so easy.
It's not going to be that simple.
But
if you like noir, if you like Vice pictures, if you like, you know, kind of the older exploitation that maybe isn't as explicit, but maybe
it isn't really is style, a little bit, but you know,
then you'll probably like this.
Yep, I did really like that one. That was a good one. And I had watched it, and like I didn't really, and then I rewatched it like for this, and I was like, I think I might have seen this before, and then I looked it up, and I was like, oh yeah, I did see it, because I checked my Letterboxd list, and I had it checked off, so like I knew I had seen it. So, but I really liked that one; that was a good pick. So I'll go to my number four, which is Walking the Edge from 1985, and it was directed by Norbert Meisel.
Walking the Edge in a violent city.
Dad! Run, Dad, run!
Family torn apart. A woman needs to settle the score.
If he was pushing drugs to young kids, maybe he deserved it. But Danny was my baby. My son.
He was an easygoing man, a nice guy with unfulfilled dreams who's been pushed too far.
You pick up and deliver. Otherwise, keep your friggin' mouth shut. Is that clear?
My friends don't talk to me that way.
I think I'm tired of getting pushed around.
A man and a woman, two strangers brought together by chance, held together by fate. They were one step ahead of sudden death.
Son of a bitch!
This is big time bad business, man. I mean, somebody did a goddamn it fry and you were right in the middle.
That's his car, Booster. Get in my fucking car! How did you get caught in a piece of shit like that?
We're gonna find that lady and cut her up into tiny little pieces.
I'll never have another chance like that!
Jesus, they were trying to kill me!
You had to get in the way, you...
I'm bleeding!
Goddamn jerk-off cabbie!
Where is he?
I don't know, ma'am!
The bastard's got Tony. God damn you, lady. God damn you for being alive.
I'll go with you.
Go to hell.
Huh? I'm gonna cut your whole fucking head off. Cut your whole fucking...
McKee. You're an asshole, McKee.
Walking the Edge, the motion picture that takes you to the depths of human emotion.
Up here, Brewster.
Dirty son of a bitch!
I gave you the best shot I could.
God damn it. If you'd have been out on the street, you'd have been dead by now.
I was thinking about you all day long. You could have called
nobody back.
Walking the Edge, starring Robert Forrester and Nancy Kwan. Coming soon to a theater near you.
And it stars Robert Forrester, Nancy Kwan, Joe Spinell, and A. Martinez. And, you know, great. Those are like, you know, I'm a big fan of Robert Forrester, so that's why I wanted to see it.
He's
and I think
wonderful in this.
Yeah, and it just came out on Blu-ray from Fun City Editions. So that's another, like, you know, if you're a collector, you can get it from them too. So if you want to watch it.
Now, do you know if this was shot earlier and shelved?
I think it might have been shot in like 1983 or something. And then it came out.
Yeah, because in the exterior scenes, there's like a billboard for Wrath of Khan, like all of them.
Yeah, it probably was. It probably was shelved or something. And then it came out, but I guess it was released theatrically by Empire Pictures. So that must have been like a couple of years after it was filmed or something. But I'll give you the little plot synopsis. So Nancy Kwan's husband is a drug dealer. That's like, or I don't know if he's, I don't think he's like actually, a, he's like partly a drug dealer, but he's like, you know, he's probably
like the fence or the transporter.
Yeah. And he's like, or he's like the front, like maybe he's like a wealthy kind of a, you know, like a business
respectable money laundering
front for these guys. But he's like, you know, dealing with these thugs that he held out on. And then they end up coming to their house and they shoot him and the son, and Nancy Kwan escapes. But she, like, you know, she barely escapes, but then she has a mental breakdown. So they throw her in a mental hospital. And then when she gets out, she's on a path to revenge. So she kind of wants to go like Miss 45 and like go shoot all these guys and kill them and stuff. So who picks her up in the cab to take her to the place? It's Robert Forster. And he's like, you know, he's just like a, you know, unassuming cabbie, and he's just like doing his thing. And so he drives her to the auto body shop where these goons work. And then she just pulls out a gun and starts shooting at him. And like, you know, they kind of like, you know, they barely, I think, I don't know if she kills one of them or whatever, but several of them, like, you know, they try to get
she
her
kills
out of there.
Two and she wounds the third.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So, and then one guy tosses like a hubcap at her and like right in the hip and wounds her or something like that. And then meanwhile, Robert Forster is like caught in the middle of this, and he's like freaking out, like, what the hell is going on? You know, he like jumps in his cab and they both jump in the cab and take off. And, you know, so then, you know, then he tries to help her by like hiding her at his apartment. So like, you know, he hides her there, and, you know, that's how the whole thing starts. And then after that, like, you know, the Joe Spinell and his goons are like looking for him and stuff. And, you know, they're trying to evade those guys, and, you know, it's all this stuff
like
happens. And
in spirit, this is pretty similar to Sweet Trash, because it opens violent. It ends violent. We've got a great performance from like a working, you know, character actor.
Yep.
As a protagonist stuck in kind of this action-packed premise, who'd rather be doing anything.
Yeah, it's like...
He'd rather probably just be collecting his money and watching his baseball, like Robert Forrester's character.
Yeah, really watching a football game with his nosy neighbor.
Yeah.
That nosy neighbor that's always...
He likes to watch football with his nosy old lady neighbor.
He can't even, like, go to the bathroom without this lady, like, knocking on the door, like, looking in the window or something.
And I feel like, spiritually, they're kind of similar because they're both carried by central performances, because the middle section is actually pretty slow in this film. It takes a while to get to the vengeance.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, because I think the Robert Forrester's character is Jason. His name is Jason in there.
Yeah.
And he's like, he sort of has like his own little ties to the underworld. Like some of his like friends are like, yeah, like some of his friends are like, you know, that guy he goes to get like to get his money, like to that pay that owes him money
he
or
works
something.
For a bookie. He's a gopher for a bookie.
Yeah, that's what it is. So he goes to that guy, and then, like, you know, they have like a face off, like a confrontation and stuff. And, you know, so he has his own little ties to the underworld. So that's part of the story too. But then, you know, most of the movie, it's like him and Nancy Kwan, they're like, you know, they're fighting, then they're kissing, then they're fighting again.
Yeah, they're,
you know,
definitely that type of, like, earmarked for the enemies, yeah, lovers trope.
Yeah. I really liked it though. It was really good. And I'm like a big Robert, you know, we both like Robert Forster. So like, we'll, you know, he's just a really good, he's like really intense.
Well, that's why I kind of didn't mind the middle section of this film being more of like travelogue and slowing down.
It's not so bad.
Really good performances.
Yeah. It's not so bad. It's not like you're like totally like, you know, you kind of like you're kind of into the story and you're like, you know, following him around. You know,
Nancy Kwan was a fantastic actress. I think.
Yeah. I really liked her.
Became a big star because there weren't great roles available for Asian actresses at that time.
Yeah. And I think I had seen her like in
Robert Forster's fantastic. Have you ever seen The Wrecking Crew with Sharon Tate? She was in that.
Yeah, I saw her in that. And I was going to mention Wonder Women. She was in that movie. You know, which that movie?
Great.
It's like, I think I think it was a Sergio Santiago movie, like a Filipino action movie from like the 1970s. But then the first time I knew Nancy Kwan was I saw her in Dragon, the Bruce Lee story, which came out in like I think it was like 1993 or something like that. But she plays like,
yeah, it was early 90s.
Yeah. I don't know if you've seen that one, but she plays the boss of, like, when Bruce Lee first came to America, like he got a job, like when he was a teenager, he got a job at a Chinese restaurant, and she was like she played the owner of the restaurant. I forget her name, like Grace Wong or something like that. But like, and she was really, you know, she was really good in that.
Very good in pretty much everything she's ever been in.
Yeah, I really liked her. It was
a matter of circumstances that she wasn't a bigger star, but she's, they have nice chemistry.
They have a good chemistry in this. And I guess her husband was the director of the movie, Norbert Meisel, which was interesting. So, but I just really liked it. That was like a new discovery that I had heard about, and, you know, like I finally saw it and I just really enjoyed it. I just thought it was a really good crime thriller.
This is great.
And also Joe Spinell.
If it was a musical subgenre,
yeah,
it would sound like the score of this movie. It's fantastic. Yeah.
And don't forget Joe Spinell. He's really good. He's like a good bad guy.
Exactly what he does. He's being the sleazy heavy we all know and love. And that's
he's really great. He's been in so many good movies too. I mean, he's been in like The Godfather. He was in Maniac. He was like in all types of stuff. Almost like every time he's in Rocky, like Taxi Driver, he's like been in like so many good movies over the years. Yeah. I mean, he's always like
played to type, and he was always brilliant at it.
But I guess he was like a really, like, I watched I think it was the Maniac DVD or something. And I watched like a documentary on him, and like, he was just like a really nice guy, like a really kind of like a fun guy.
And that imposing looking, and you look like a bad motherfucker. What do you have to prove? You can afford to be nice.
Right. He's like, he didn't have to do anything, but he was just like, he seemed like a really nice person and stuff. So, but anyways, that was my number four pick. And you liked that one too, right? So
yeah, that was a fun, I had
Walking the Edge. Yeah. So, and it's on Blu-ray again. So if people want to see it, they can check it out on there.
All right. So we're going to just go third pick. Of course, no random order. Like I said, I just pulled them off my list.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's no big deal.
Common Law Wife.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is William Turner, a member of a selected committee appointed to preview in private the motion picture Common Law Wife. And while we feel that a story of this sort must be told, out of deference to those of you who have young ones present, no scenes from the motion picture will be previewed. The story begins in a cheap motel room such as this. This is not the kind of place in which people like you or I would be found. However, the facts speak for themselves. Cheap whiskey. Cheaper perfume. And uninhibited love. These are the conditions that lead men and women to a depraved climax. A climax from which there is no point of return. However, this is only the beginning. One woman wasn't enough. They didn't care. Kinfolk, neighbors, friends, or whenever the animal urge arose. Remember, you do not have to say, I do, to be married. Do you know the law in this state? Ask your wife, relatives, or friends if they know the law. In the motion picture, Common Law Wife, they did not know the law. And it led to uncontrolled lust and passion. Frankly, ladies and gentlemen, this is not the kind of motion picture any thinking parent would want his children to see. However, if you are old enough to be married, you must see this picture. If you are not old enough to be married, you cannot. Remember, you do not have to say, I do, to be married. See Common Law Wife.
From 1961, the credited director is Eric Sayers, but half of the film was shot by Larry Buchanan. This is a principal example of like exploitation hustle, because the original film was Larry Buchanan's. It was called Swamp Rose. It was a serious drama about an aging rich man and his mistress. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, that film was not completed. It ran out of funding for production. It's unclear as to why. So a distributor picked up the unfinished film and hired a second director to shoot basically additional footage and make like a Franken film out of these originals.
That definitely seems like a normal thing of with exploitation back then. Like they probably did that a lot back then, didn't they?
This is one of the oldest examples, but it's definitely not the
That was a normal thing. Yeah.
So basically you end up with a very rich old man. He's had a mistress living with him for the past 5 years, but he's decided he's bored of her and he's going to trade her in for a younger model who also happens to be his own niece.
What's his name? What's her name? Jonelle,
but they call her Baby Doll, which is Baby an Doll. Obvious reference to the Tennessee Williams hit from 1956.
Yeah, we mentioned that one on the other podcast too, I think. You mentioned Baby.
I think I might have because a lot of films make reference to it. It was a common.
Yeah, it was Carol thing. Baker. Remember, we were talking about Carol Baker.
Yeah, we were discussing Carol Baker, and a lot of other like exploitation adjacent films kind of want to align themselves with that film because it was kind of a rural sort of.
It was like almost like the little blueprint, like Shanty Tramp or something. It would be kind of like a little.
Baby Doll was actually a very high budget. Like I said, it won Oscars.
It did. And it.
Yeah. But like everybody kind of lined themselves up with making a sleazier version of that movie. You would often find references to Baby Doll.
That's pretty cool. But I really like this one too. And also the start of the movie, I thought was really crazy. The old guy, Uncle Shug, whatever his name is.
Yeah. Shug Foot.
He's like, the first thing you see him doing is throwing darts at his wife, which was like, what the hell?
Yeah, and the two of them are bickering while he's what is throwing the hell? Darts at her head.
Throwing darts at her head, like while she's sitting in a chair.
You know, you're
okay, this movie's going to be different.
Dysfunction.
Yeah, I was like, this movie's going to be weird after seeing that.
And the thing with that I kind of really like about this movie is it is a complete Frankenstein, but it's so bold about it that it
I really like that, though.
Makes it all work.
I really like that aspect.
Baby Doll is played by two different actresses.
Yeah. It was played by two different actresses. Jonelle, you're saying, was played by two different actresses?
Baby Doll / Jonelle was played by two different actresses. Because in the original footage, it's Lacey Kelly from Doris Wishman's Nude on the Moon.
Oh my God. I didn't know that one.
You didn't even notice, right? Well, here's the thing. In the new footage that Eric Sayers shot, and you can tell the difference in the quality of the prints. You can tell the difference in the grain.
Yeah.
They just took another actress and acted like nothing happened.
It was probably like,
They try to cover her face.
Okay. They gave her that wig or something. And they like made her like just strut around.
And then they don't even bother to do that toward the back half of the film. They have her in full close up.
Okay. And so I didn't even notice that. So it worked because I didn't notice it.
Yeah. And she's similar looking, but not the same.
That's funny.
Because they're so brazen in like not even trying to hide it. It almost tricks your brain into thinking it's the same person.
And also the movie, like I thought, like you're saying, like how it's sort of like a Frankenstein film. I thought they like did that on purpose. Like I thought, like, you know, like it was just like all over the place. It was just like, you know, it was so up and down and every way, like, you know, one place, like, you know, they'd be running through the woods, then they'd be back at the apartment, like, you know, like all this like weird stuff. Like it kept my attention though, the way like it was like edited together and stuff. I don't know. I just thought it was.
And you've got all of your, again, you've got all of your standard Hicksploitation tropes. You've got,
yeah, it does. You got the moonshiner,
a dysfunctional family with like a heavy whiff of.
You got the hillbilly out in the, yeah. You've got the guy that comes in.
Hillbilly. You've got the crooked sheriff. You've got the religious hypocrite. You've got the hot to trot, you know, wrong side of the tracks tramp. You've got all your basic beats.
And you got the old guy that has money, like that they're, you know, they're trying to like wait for the money.
You've got all your basic Hicksploitation tropes in this like overheated melodrama.
Yeah.
And what impressed me about this film was how engaging it was, considering it's patchwork together.
Yeah, it was pretty engaging too. I was just like, you know.
Short. So it gets in and gets out before the effect
starts
to wear thin.
I just really liked it. I thought, like, you know, because I was watching it and I was just like, what the hell is going to happen next? Like type thing. And like, I didn't know.
The ending is about as dark as a ending from.
Yeah, it was very, very much. I was like, wow, that was pretty great.
Yeah. It gets grim in the final reel. And I respect that. I was like, that's bold.
It really went all the way.
What this was released in. That was a very bold choice.
What year was it released?
I want to say it was mostly shot around 61 because we're again talking two separate films and released in 63.
Yeah. And it also like, I mean, it did have like, I think like Faster Pussycat Kill Kill had like sort of like a, not the same plot, but like, you know, the old guy with the, you know, like he's sort of like, you know, that they're trying to get his money or something, whatever it was, but different type of movie. But I did like this one a lot.
Old guy with money soon parted.
Yeah. I did really like this one a lot though. That was like another little gem like that you picked out.
I'm trying, like this year I kind of felt like this was the year of like this is the bottom of a double bill movie. It's clearly the like B feature, but a lot of them were really enjoyable. That was a lot of kind of the vibe of this year.
I wonder what it would have played with on like on the
I'm guessing the something like Shanty Tramp.
Oh yeah.
Shanty I'm guessing Tramp. it would have, you know, Shanty Tramp.
What year was Shanty Tramp though? I thought that was later on.
It was later on, but this is going to be this.
This would be the double. This would be the bottom of the double bill.
Bottom of the bill, which is usually an older film.
Right. That's true.
We'll figure, you know, it could have played with Shanty Tramp. It could have played with Scum of the Earth. It could have played with like 2000 Maniacs, maybe.
Yeah, some Herschel Gordon Lewis movie or something. Or,
yeah, like it could have played with like those.
I bet it could even have played with like, you know, a Russ Meyer movie. It could have been like Mudhoney and Common Law Wife. Yeah,
for sure.
That's another movie it sort of like reminded me of, I think.
Yeah.
Like, that's another favorite of mine.
This, I didn't double check for alternate titles, but I'm sure this kicked around on the bottom of double bills for long enough where it would have played with some of those films.
Right. Definitely. Yeah. That was a really good one though. Excellent pick. Okay. So I'll go on to my number three or number three on the list. I won't say the number three, but you know,
whatever. Number three.
So this one is Siege, and it also went by Self Defense, and it came out in 1983, and it was directed by Paul Donovan.
A police strike paralyzes an entire city and unleashes a violent new order. Suddenly, every citizen must arm and protect themselves.
What do we got to defend ourselves with?
The attackers have every kind of weapon. The innocent defenders have only their courage and their cunning to survive the siege. City, tomorrow, yours.
And it was set.
And also Maura O'Connell. They share a co-director.
Oh, yeah. There was another person too. But it was filmed in Halifax, and the movie is set during a police strike in the city. And there's a gang of hateful fascist goons. They're basically Nova Scotia's version of the Proud Boys, and they call themselves the New Order. And they're like, you know, the movie starts and they decide to go to like a gay bar and attack like, you know, the patrons at the bar and like, you know, terrorize the place. But after a heated confrontation and an armed standoff, the New Order's leader just executes everybody in the place. But one of the guys manages to get free, and the thugs chase him, and he barely escapes, and he ends up at an apartment building where the residents save him. And then, like, you know, these people are just unassuming average Joes, and the New Order thugs try to convince them that he's an escaped mental patient, and they're going to take him back to the hospital. But they're like, you know, we know that that's bullshit. So, you know, they just help the guy, like, you know, stay away. They help they save the guy from these New Order fascist thugs. And then, like, that's how the movie starts. And then, like, you know, the siege begins, and that's like basically the whole synopsis of the movie. And then, like, you
I'm
know,
I'm really just, glad you picked this one, because this is probably my favorite like Canadian tax shelter film.
Yeah, I haven't seen a ton of like low budget Canadian movies, but this was, you know, one that really stood out.
It's mean. It gets in. It gets out. It never stops moving. This movie understands that movies must move.
Right. And it also, like, if you're a fan of like Assault on Precinct 13, which I am, that's like, I immediately thought, like if you watch it, like you'll immediately think like, okay, this is like kind of like a, you know, a Nova Scotia version of Assault on, but there's no cops in this one because of course there's a police strike going on. So there's cops around, which was kind of a good little way to, you know, to explain why they're, because usually when you watch these movies, like they're trying to explain why there's no cops around. And it's like, that was a good little, you know, detail that explains that.
It happened,
you know?
I think, in 81.
Yeah. And I didn't really know anything about that.
Recently in audience's memory when this came out.
Yeah. I mean, I was like a little baby when this movie came out, but little kid when this movie came out, but but I just thought it was awesome. And like, you know, like the, and it's like, I just got caught up in the story, and I didn't really like expect to like it this much. And then one thing I really liked about it was the drama and the action never stops. Like you were saying, it's really well paced, and you know, there's always something going on, and the average people in the apartment use all their wits and courage to hold off the attackers. And then even has like those A-team style homemade weapons and booby traps that they set up and that type of stuff.
Almost like a dark-sided Home Alone with.
Yeah. It's sort of like that type of thing
that they get with, you know, their traps and their weapons. Right.
You know, they're just like these people like hanging out. Like, I just thought it was funny. Like, they're just like basically like people hanging out on a Friday night, and like all of a sudden this guy like shows up
and have some burgers. And
yeah, like, they're like, you know, just like kind of like nerdy, like in a way, almost like nerdy people, just like, you know, nerdy, like Nova Scotia people hanging out in their apartment. They're like, what the hell, you know? These guys show up and it's like
really convincingly grim.
Yeah.
Like the violence definitely is effective. But
and I thought it was very, yeah. Sorry.
Principles in the right place.
And I thought it was very like relevant to today, like with the New Order guys. Like I was just thinking, like, you know, that's basically just like the Proud Boy, like, you know, those fascist groups.
And
you know what I mean?
Like, it's the same exact thing. That the fascists, it's pretty clear that the only reasonably intelligent person is their leader.
Right. Cade,
the rest of them are just dumbasses playing for power.
Yeah, they're just dumbasses. Like the main guy,
want something to belong to, and they want something to feel better than.
And they're really pissed off.
Dumbass, like angry, sad little men.
And And the lead
them as being like super badass because they're not.
They're not. They're just a bunch of like, you know, like they're just a bunch of like beer drinking jerks that, like, you know, have nothing better to do.
Yeah,
almost.
If they didn't have numbers and a gun behind them, they wouldn't be anything.
Take their anger out on, like, you know, gay people or something.
Innocent people and, you know, gay.
I mean, because it. Because the main guy, Goose, you know, the main guy that, like, we first meet him at his house. And, like, the first thing we see him do is his wife gives him, like,
did
a little,
you
like.
Watch the Severin DVD cut? Because
yeah, I didn't
see. That scene is not in the theatrical cut.
The scene where he's, like, his wife is like a, you know, she does, like, pottery and stuff. He basically just, yeah, like, he demolishes everything she's made, like, and, like, you know, like, just destroys the whole room. And she's like, he's like, you know, it just shows you, like, the type of person he is. He just doesn't give, you know, he's just, like, such a cruel person, like, and just a jerk, like, you know.
His wife hates him. But,
yeah,
you know,
so he's like, she's like, I made you this sandwich. She's like, I made you a sandwich. And he's like, is this margarine on this? He, like, digs it and throws it away.
You know, if you watch the theatrical cut, that opening
it's not
scene
there.
With the additional exposition isn't there, but it's very clearly implied who's in the right and who's in the wrong here.
Right.
It's not
definitely. I mean, you know. But you know, all these people, all like the gay people, they're just like, you know, it's just
they're just
the way they do
it. At a bar.
Yeah, they're just hanging out in a bar. So it's like, you know, we know like those types of people. We know like we've seen it like in our own country. So we know exactly what it is.
We've seen this play out in real time. Yeah.
So that was awesome. But but I guess Canucksploitation.com calls it an unheralded landmark of Canadian B film. So it's a good little
rating. That. From what I've seen of, you know, tax shelter cinema and Canadian, you know,
what would be another, have you seen like, what would be another one that you'd like, that you like that?
Well, you know, all of the early Cronenberg films are technically.
Oh yeah. Shivers and Rabid and all those. Yeah. I like those too.
Those are certainly important.
Yeah. Those were really good too.
You know, out of what I've seen, and I always Murder by Phone, which is very corny, but I always have loved it because
I don't know
so
if I've
creepy.
Seen that. Murder by Phone. Might have,
the alternate title is Bells, but you know, Canucksploitation has a lot of really cool little films in it. But this is probably my favorite. I would definitely agree with their assessment that this is.
That's
like
good.
A
I didn't know that. I didn't even know you were a fan of this one. But I just saw it like recently, and I was like, wow, this is awesome. Especially, you know what I mean? Because I was saying like a Assault on Precinct 13. Like I just thought like it was like a nice kind of like a different version of that.
Also, I love how even the survivalist in this one, like, isn't some weird right winger. He knows that the fascists need to die. Their neighbor, Tester.
Oh,
he
talks
through the medicine cabinet because
that's another thing I was going to mention. I like how they have the little connecting, like, they have these connecting apartments.
That's a real
thing
in tenement buildings. That also plays a part in the original Candyman and the case that inspired Candyman, because that's a real thing in certain project buildings and tenement buildings.
I didn't even know they had that. I thought that was just like a little freak, like little thing that they did for the movie.
No, in certain project buildings and tenement buildings, there are actually throughways in the medicine.
That is awesome. And then they have the little connecting, like, well, they're not connecting, but they have the little skylight things, the little skylight, you know.
The little skylight thing seemed to me as a bit plot convenient, but whatever. It doesn't matter.
That was kind of neat too, but I just like that little detail. But this is, you know, it's just a really good like thriller if you like those types of action thrillers. I
mean, some of the sound effects are a little goofy.
Yeah,
like some of the gun sound effects sound too much like lasers.
And
obviously with all of the traps and kills and action, there's not a ton of room for character development, but they keep it simple, they keep it fast, they keep it moving. And like I said, for a film that's this grim, it has all its ideology in the right place.
And I
it
do like
it belongs to the right people.
And I do really like the payoff with the gay guy, whatever his name was, Danielle, I think his name was. But there's a good payoff with him. So you have to watch the movie and you'll see like what I mean. Kind of a good little ending, like with him.
Well, he gets a good ending. The overall ending is a very dark one.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
But then the ending of the movie is, I actually really, really liked the end of the ending of the movie too, the way they did it. That was like a good little sting at the end, you know?
And the directors have gone on record saying they weren't trying to be political. I don't know that I buy that.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, it's, you have to have some side, you're taking some side with that story. I mean, you can't be like, oh yeah, well, this is we're not political at all about this.
Well, I mean, Romero used to claim the same thing. So we're just going to side.
I don't know if I buy that so much. I don't think so. Not with Night of the Living Dead, with the last guy is, you know, the lead guy is a black man. And it's like, you know, but anyways. Yeah, so that was shot in 14 days. That's pretty amazing.
I mean, for the budget, for the price point, for what it is,
they did a good job with
that little film. So, theatrical cut or the extended cut, you can't go wrong either way.
Yeah, and it's on Blu-ray from Severin, is it?
Yeah, Severin.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that's definitely one. You know, I'm trying not to like get into like recommending movies. Like, I like to just like. So that kind of like leaves me out of like, you know, I bought this movie and it sucks. And you suck too. Like, it leaves me out of that thing. I just want to say what I like. And if you like it, if you watch it and you like it, that's cool. If you don't, then whatever.
If you watch these movies and you don't like them, feel free to at me. I won't care, but you can.
Get into like a big like Twitter war over it.
Well, no, because like, I'm just making recommendations. I hope people enjoy them. But if you don't, like, you know, don't at me. Don't.
Yeah. And we all have our taste. Yeah. I mean, like if you watch Common Law of Wife, like I'm into those types of movies. So like I watched that and I knew exactly like why you liked it, but someone else that's not into exploitation. Yeah,
right. I mean, obviously all of this, I'm trying to, you know, if you like this sort of thing, you might also like this. Obviously I'm not the arbiter of all movie taste in the world. So take what you will from it. Your mileage may vary and stop being so terminally joyless.
Exactly. Okay. So what are we on to? Your number two? I think.
Yes, correct.
Okay, number two.
All right, and we're going back across to the other side of the pond with 1959's CoverGirl Killer.
You hesitate to take your clothes off in front of me, but you're quite happy to exhibit your nakedness before the whole world on the front of this filthy magazine.
Behind the scenes of the backstage jungle, the shocking story of the girls who pay the ultimate price for a ticket to fame and fortune, whose appearance on the cover of a notorious magazine marks them for violent death. Who is this monster? A modern-day Jack the Ripper, obsessed beyond desire by the image of woman, driven to commit crimes more shocking than the screen has ever shown.
That costume, put it on. You must, Miss Rawson, you must. It's important that everybody should see exactly why you had to die.
CoverGirl. Yeah, this was good too. I like this one too.
This is so simple. This is such a simple little B picture. Okay, we've got a trashy, like,
it was very simple. Yeah.
It's called Wow, and it's a magazine for people who can't read.
Wow.
Because it's mostly pictures of pretty girls.
Yep.
And the centerfolds keep turning up dead. So obviously there is a killer stalking the streets of Soho and stalking the cover girls of this magazine. And it is up to a journalist from the magazine and the local police to try and figure out who it is. Mm-hmm. Very simple plot. This is absolutely, you know, you're not going to be super shocked by anything that happens. I'm not saying this is a wildly original film. But what is enjoyable about it is that it's very dryly funny. Mm-hmm. The dialogue is a bit sharper than these films typically are.
Yep.
In a refreshing change, the police are not super useless and the hero isn't a complete jerk about the women that he's working with in the context of his magazine.
Right.
He doesn't look down on them. He doesn't view them as lesser. He's very concerned that someone is targeting them, which a lot of the movies that tend to deal with like glamour modeling or sex work tend to, you know, treat them as very disposable, but at least everyone in this film seems to be on the same page that and it's sad that this is something that's notable, that these people's lives have value and we should probably find out who's killing them.
Right.
Like, which seems like common sense to me, but in the extended genre cinematic universe, maybe not so much.
And I was really impressed by the efficiency of the acting and direction. That it was just like, and it's I think it was only 60 minutes long, right?
Yeah, it's like a little over an hour.
It's like really like, it's pretty, pretty quick. But I was also thinking it could be like a stage play or something. Like you can almost do it like in...
You almost like could have. Thing. You would need like maybe two sets. It was close. And sometimes the police sequences are a little talky.
Yeah.
Obviously by plot necessity. I just want to point out that our central big bad is played by a comedian named...
he's a comedian? That guy was a comedian?
Yeah, he's actually famous as a comedian, Harry H. Corbett. I believe the show was called Steptoe and Son.
Oh yeah, Steptoe. I've heard of that. Steptoe and Son.
He's clearly having a great time
playing
a villain.
And he's sort of like a Jack the Ripper type guy. Yeah, he's like Jack the Ripper or like something like that, or Peeping Tom.
Honestly, the closest analog, if you've ever seen The Playbirds from 1978, They almost have the exact same. It stole the plot from this and made it nastier and sleazy.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one, but the movies that I've seen that remind me of was like Peeping Tom or those types of movies. Like,
well, it's not quite that clever.
Not as clever as that, but it's almost like
Peeping
a real.
Peeping Tom is a classic.
Very basic version of there's no like camera in it or anything like that.
An enjoyable get in and out in 60 minutes. Yep. Little B picture. Yeah, I also thought it was very funny that this is again someone who hides in plain sight.
And then his disguise, that was like the worst. Basically, the worst
like
disguise
ever. Middle-aged raincoater.
Worst disguise ever. I don't know.
Yeah, but the thing is, in a vice district, if you look like a generic gross raincoater, that just wants to leer at pretty girls,
a raincoater. A raincoater. That's funny.
Like, you know, if you look like you're heading to the adult theater or the peep booth,
no one cares. No one cares who that guy is.
Yeah, nobody.
Everybody ignores the pervert guy. Everybody ignores the perverted looking guy.
Well, you know, if you're in an area that's catering to
that's true.
Salacious interests, there's that guy every 5 minutes.
But he looked so he looked so like creepy. He had like the bad wig, the Coke bottle, glasses. He just like didn't look good. He looked like really weird.
Some of the models took him seriously as like a movie producer.
Yeah, that was really weird.
One of them, he's like a musician.
Because he was creeping me out, and I'm not like, you know, I wasn't even.
Yeah, he definitely is very, very creepy.
Yeah, that was really.
This is such an enjoyable little B picture. Yeah, this is the sort of thing that makes those 50 movie like public domain sets kind of worth it.
It flies by. It was like a really quick move.
Yeah, it's cheap. It's cheerful. It gets in, it gets out. It has a little fun and we're done.
Right. It was good. I liked it. Okay. So I'll go on to my number two pick. And that was one that someone on the December, they recommended this one to me. And it's funny because I've seen like a lot of blaxploitation films, but this was the one, like one of the very few that I hadn't seen yet. So I wanted to check that out. And it's Gordon's War from 1973, and it was directed by Ossie Davis.
It's war, baby. It's Gordon's War. The battlefield is Harlem. The enemy is junk. The general is a cat named Gordon.
Hey! I give the orders!
He spent 4 years in the NAM, fighting someone else's battle. Now he's back to fight his own. He's got a four-man army and a foolproof plan.
As you can see, we're well prepared.
Step one, infiltrate enemy territory.
You big pig?
Where you want?
Step two, cut the supply line.
Gentlemen, we have a problem. Our largest New York franchise is having distribution difficulties.
Step three, harass the hostiles. Step four, search and destroy.
I bet he got his head right here.
I'm through playing with you, Luca.
Watch your teeth.
Step five, knock out the heavy artillery. Take an army to get dope out of Harlem. This is an army. And this is Gordon's War.
And, Ossie Davis had directed Cotton Comes to Harlem, and that's sort of like a proto-blaxploitation.
And he had an amazing career as a performer. Like, he's a legend.
Yeah, he is. Yeah. Married to Ruby Dee. And if you've seen the movie Do the Right Thing, he plays DeMaya in Do the Right Thing. You'll know him from that. Well, you know, people that are into the, like, you know, exploitation films will know him best from that one, I think. And but Gordon's War is like, you know, I'm a big fan of the film Superfly, and this is sort of like the anti-Superfly, because where Superfly was coming from the pusher's point of view, Gordon's War is coming from like the people affected by the, you know, the drug dealer's point of view. So, you know, Paul Winfield plays Gordon, and he's a, you know, if you've seen the movie Sounder or Terminator, you'll know him from that. And
you might know him by his voice. He's done a ton of voiceover work. He has a very distinctive speaking voice. So even if you've never seen anything that he's in, the second he speaks, he'll be familiar to you.
Yeah, he's really good. And he plays a war vet, and he comes home and finds out his wife has died from a drug overdose. So he's like really like, you know, upset about this, as anyone would be. So he just decides to personally go after all the pushers and pimps in town. And he enlists the help of his old pals, one of which is Superfly's Carl Lee. You'll know him as Eddie in that film. He plays the character Eddie, you know, a priest's like buddy in that film. And then you'll also see Superfly's Charles McGregor. We talked about Charles McGregor before, from The Baron.
Yes, because he was in The Baron.
He plays one of like, you know, he plays like a criminal in this film that like, you know,
he's a pusher on a subway platform.
One of the guys they go after. So basically that's the plot of the film is Gordon and his buddies, like they just like set up like a headquarters in this like abandoned building, slummy building. And they just go after all the pushers and pimps and stuff. And that's the whole movie basically in a nutshell, but it's like, you know, it was an awesome like thriller. It was like always like, there was always something going on and, you know, they're taking out all the different pushers and stuff. And it was just really exciting. And it just went all the way to the very end and it just held up really well. And, you know, of course,
really
like, you know,
I loved the use of color and costuming and kind of this movie obviously didn't have a lot of budget.
No, I don't think so.
A lot of interesting compositions, like especially in terms of the costuming of like the pimps and the pushers.
Yeah, it has a great soundtrack too. Yeah, a great soundtrack.
Also the opening credit sequence where you have the topless women cutting the cocaine under a black light.
Oh yeah, yeah. That was awesome. Yeah, that was really cool.
Yeah, there's a lot of nice little like visually interesting touches that are really interesting to look at for the price point.
Yep, definitely.
Obviously, because you have an actor director at the helm, the performances are universally very good. I feel like they're better than they have any right to be for something that, you know, generally wasn't given as much character development.
Right.
It also has some really cool grace notes about he just came home from a war,
right?
You know, a literal war, only to face another war of what people are doing to his neighborhood.
Yeah, that was really
drugs
awesome.
And crime.
Yeah, and it's like he's going from one war to another war, and he's also like in that mode still. He's still like in like, you know, in still in, you know, the war mode. So it's
I think
like,
the implication is he kind of has to be. There is no peace.
Right. And also, like, you know, of course, having his wife die, that just like triggers his like, you know, he's like, OK, let's set up the thing. Let's go after them ourselves because we know that, you know, the police aren't going to do it.
You know, the authorities and the police and they're not looking out for us. They're not trying to save our kids. You know, they're not trying to get the drugs out of our neighborhood.
Right.
We have to do it ourselves.
And also, it's really like this type of movie is really like the epitome of the classic blaxploitation film, because the man, as we know, is, you know, it's always like a rich white people, and the villains in this are actually the, you know, the rich white businessmen who are supplying all the drugs to the pushers. So it's like there seems
to be an implication they might be mafia.
Yeah, I thought they were like you know, like the front where they're rich white business.
They're subcontracting to like various neighborhood people, but the implication is probably that the dudes in the boardroom might have more than a few Italian connections.
Yeah, they probably do. I mean, they're all like hooked into all that stuff. But anyways, we know they're like the rich white guys, as opposed it's like not the you know, the lower class black people who are doing it that are in charge of it. They're just like, you know, the second.
They're pawns in a larger game they're, you know, heads, the crime lords win, tails, the neighborhood loses.
It just shows you the levels of, you know, how everything works. And also, so I mean, that was just awesome. That was an awesome film.
A lot of especially blaxploitation films have those kind of war room, like talking it out scenes.
Yeah.
This is one of the greatest examples of that there is. Like, this is definitely probably the reference point for a similar scene in Black Dynamite, if you've ever watched that.
Oh, yeah, Black Dynamite. I probably noticed that.
It's delightful. It's a delightful homage to, like, you know, exploitation
movies. Yeah, those.
Yeah, but this is such a fantastic war room scene. Like, they've got the push pins, they've got the maps, they've got the ambiguously blinking machinery. It's fantastic. And you have a better than average cast of actors to kind of make what is objectively a little silly work.
Yeah. It definitely held up though. I mean, I was like, I didn't know if it was gonna, you know, go all the way to the end and like, but the whole thing, it was really an exciting film all the way through. So that was a good little surprise that I just, you know,
I do wonder if there was a little bit of producer meddling though.
I don't know.
Because there's some very nice character work in the first half of the film. And you can tell that they're trying to make these analogs and these grace notes of like a war overseas versus a war at home versus the life of urban neighborhoods. Yep. And then through the back half, that kind of gets pushed aside. So I wonder if like a producer or a distributor.
We need more action. No, we need more stunt. Yeah, we need more action here and forget about the character development. Yeah,
stop trying to be serious, goddamn it. We need more explosions.
And there was a good, like, awesome, like, car chase through there and then stuff like that.
There is a very, it's like up and around, like, the West Side Highway, I think.
Yeah, that was mint. Yeah. That was really cool. But I mean, it just, yeah, just this one was one that really delivered for me. Like, I kind of like, I've seen so many of these movies. So I'm like, I'm watching it for like, you know, all these things. I'm looking for it to hit these beats. Like you always say, like, you know, did it do this? Did it deliver on that? Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah. Where is the narrative payoff? Where is the, you know, where
yeah, I mean, I just like, you know, and it's not like, it's not really like the, you know, the story is like super complicated or anything. It's just, he's basically doing it for his wife. Like, you know, like his wife that died, like, you know, he's just trying to get back at the all the, you know, and for the for more than just her, for like, you know, the neighborhood and stuff.
For all of the wives and all of the kids and all of
all the kids and everything. So it's just, it was just a good, well told, nicely directed, you know, action film. So
yeah, I was definitely like, I had fun with it. Also, there is a small cameo from a very young Grace Jones.
Oh yeah, Grace Jones. Yeah, I remember that too.
Which is always reason to stand up and cheer, in my view, because the world needs as much Grace Jones as they can get.
Yeah, she was good. Little I noticed.
Yeah, it was just basically a little cameo part, yeah. But I just love her.
I haven't seen her in a ton of movies. Like I saw her like in this one, I saw her in the James Bond movie.
Obviously.
I saw her in the James Bond. And then wasn't she in Vamp or something?
She had a substantive part in Vamp.
Yeah, so that's, I don't really, and then I know like some of her
honestly, I feel like she kind of is above pedestrian concerns, like having to do movies. She just appears places and people let her do stuff because like, she's her.
Like remember her and Dolph Lundgren? They just like go to like parties and like the whole place would just like stop because they showed up.
They were just impossible looking. They like,
and they were like, how are people what this, the hell? Like,
they were just, how are people this good looking? How
I know, they were just like, really, real? Like striking looking. That was an interesting matchup, interesting team up.
Yeah, but I, of course, I was like, oh, Grace Jones. I got very excited.
Dolph Lundgren.
But hail Queen Grace.
But also, Gordon's War, I guess it's not on Blu-ray yet. So that's another one that we need to get on Blu-ray because that's really definitely, I'm surprised about that. I didn't realize
what it was. Yeah, I feel like this is something that should. But again, it could be a rights issue. Sometimes that ties things up for a very long time.
But so that's my number two pick. Another one that I really liked.
All right.
We are on to number one.
Yes, we are on to wrap this up. This was probably my absolute favorite of this year's December. I had so much fun with this movie.
Yeah.
Evil Come, Evil Go from 1972, directed by Walt Davis. I don't know necessarily how to characterize this movie, but you have Cleo O'Hara as Sister Sarah Jane Butler, a deranged evangelist who wants to rid the world of pleasurable sex and horny men and filth and disgustingness. And she's willing to do it, you know, via street preaching or via the edge of a switchblade, whichever works.
God, this movie was funny. So funny. Street preaching or hacking up men.
Yes.
What either one.
It is a softcore film. It is a proto slasher. It is. Honestly, because the character is so over the top, she's like this exaggerated Southern belle who dresses like, you know, an extra and whatever happened to Baby Jane, who has
funny,
you know,
stuff.
This axe to grind against men. It's implied that maybe like a man left her.
Yeah, something happened to her.
And she's turned it into, I have a mission from God. We always love a sex film that has a fully produced theme song. Here it's a folk pop tune about how insane she is.
Sarah Jane, Sister Sarah Jane, you're insane or whatever, you know, whatever it says.
And I mean, she is. She absolutely is.
She definitely is.
So we've got weird, unappealing softcore sex. We've got hilarious, like hypocritical plot lines that show kind of the hypocrisy of moral crusaders, like when she's trying to con a hot dog vendor into giving her free food as a charitable donation. And you know, she's a woman of the Lord and she's a woman of the cloth, but she's never far away from swearing and or whiskey.
Oh, that's so funny. This movie was like this was definitely the funniest movie out of all, the funniest film out of all.
Yeah, to everyone's taste, because obviously there's sex, there's gore, there's religious themes.
Yeah.
But if you like The Devil's Cleavage by George Cukor, if
you know
like
what it,
super campy, ridiculous also, kind of offensive films.
Yep. It also had like a little touch of a Night of the Hunter in there. Not that he was after like any money or
like somebody figured out that The Night of the Hunter was a popular movie and this is what came out.
I don't know. It's almost like if Night of the Hunter and John Waters had a child. This is what.
Well, Walt Davis was a performer as well as a director, primarily in pornography, and this definitely feels like him kind of having a poke and a joke and a laugh at how silly moral crusaders are.
Yeah. And it definitely
was dirty and everything is filthy and nobody should have it. But wait, let me see that again.
I know. And it's like, then she's like, it's just so like weird the way she's like, and then she does the thing where she, indoctrinates that girl Penny into her
It's kind of lost because Penny is like ostracized by her family for being a lesbian. And so her rich family basically just bought her a house and sent her away to California so they could pretend she didn't exist. So Penny is just looking for something to belong to.
Funny.
And it came in the form of Sister Sarah Jane.
Oh my God. That was funny. It's just the whole movie. I was just like kind of just laughing at like what she was doing. And
as distasteful and as violent and as sex filled as this movie is, none of the sex is sexy.
No, it's not at all.
Very over the top. I mean, at one point, Sister Sarah Jane, best line in the film, shrieks at a couple that lives behind the house she's staying at. Don't you dare begat in front of me. Like clearly this
that's one of the best lines.
Very dark comedy.
There was so many like funny lines in there and I can't even remember all of them, but it was just like,
intended to be, coal black comedy, but still comedic.
Very, very, very funny. And it's just like, and even like the little sex scenes, I mean, they're just sort of like not, they're really like
they're scored to unattractive music. They're indifferently shot. Like it's clearly like, yes, we'll put this here, but this is all kind of a big joke. It's also like, a silly little fun fact. Porn legend John Holmes did all the gore effects and is also credited as the assistant director.
That's pretty funny. I mean,
and I the assistant director credit is begging for like a tripod joke, but tripod.
It's like all this sex stuff. It was like limp noodles and hair pies. That's what I called it.
Well, this is kind of in that weird liminal period where softcore and sexploitation were on their way out, but hardcore had not yet taken over because this is 1972.
Yeah. And also when Sister Sarah, like when she attacks somebody, like she'll like, they'll show her like stabbing the person and it almost looks like that she's like trying to do it in slow motion herself.
I love the way she chews the scenery. I love all of her odd character choices. Like this is an actress that maybe things didn't work out so well for her. And this might've been like one of her only shots at a lead.
Right. And she's like,
because she's similarly delightful and kind of over the top camp in another film of Walt Davis's called Oh, You Beautiful Doll. That one is actually pretty dull except for her, whereas Evil Come Evil Go is hilarious.
She sort of reminded me of like Edith Massey from John Waters movies. Like she's not like quite as loud and like, loud and weird as her, but she's like, she had like sort of like her line readings reminded me of her for some reason. I don't know why. Just the way she like.
I don't know what specifically it is. Maybe it's something in the tone of it. Like I'm not sure because they're physically pretty dissimilar.
They're different. Yeah, not physically, but like just like the way, if you watch the way like they read the lines, like if you listen to like their lines, like it's just like
the inflection and like the
It's just something about that. I just thought she was so funny. Like she was like reading it off a cue card or something. I don't know. It was just weird.
But yeah, I am genuinely flummoxed as to who this movie was supposed to be for because it's got too much sex in it to satisfy the slasher crowd. The gore is not
enough sex to satisfy the sex crowd.
sex like for the raincoaters. I'm not really sure who this movie was supposed to be for, but I'm absolutely delighted it exists.
It's such a weird little oddity. And it's just the music and stuff. I just, she's playing her, what do you call it? The thing she plays on the street.
I think it's an accordion.
Accordion. I can never think of that word. The accordion. She's like, and someone's like stopping by. They're like kind of watching her. She's singing. They're like, who the hell is this nutcase?
Well, I mean, she's on Hollywood Boulevard, so she's probably not even a notable addition.
And also through the whole movie, like they're singing like those like religious songs. They're like,
they
shall we gather at the river?
Like, At one point, one of her victims is like, why are you singing hymns while we're having
While we're having sex, or whatever. Wacky
film. Even I'm flummoxed as many odd films as I've watched. Who exactly the movie was supposed to be for?
I really don't know. Absolutely, it was really weird.
It was my favorite film out of all the films I watched for this year's December. There is a Vinegar Syndrome disc that has three Walt Davis films. I don't like the other two films on that disc nearly as much as this one, but I do wholeheartedly recommend Evil Come, Evil Go. Yeah, it's camp, really, it's black comedy. It's a good time. Have fun with it.
It was really funny. It was definitely the funniest one I've seen out of December, for sure. Okay, I'll go on to my number one. And this is a movie that I learned about from last year. And I wanted to discuss it because I just thought it was really a cool oddity, I didn't really know what to expect from it. But, and also the title and the poster kind of mislead you, because the movie is Malibu High, and it's from 1979. It was directed by Irvin Berwick.
I'm going to get the highest grades, and studying isn't going to have anything to do with it.
Kim wants to graduate from Malibu High with honors. Most kids do it by making grades. Kim does it by making appointments.
What are you doing after school? If you're interested, I'll be at High Point.
I'm not interested.
High Point. I'll be there.
She's studying with the best instructors at Malibu High. And if she can't learn enough from 9 to 3...
You game for a little game?
She takes her teachers on a field trip.
Well, that's an offer hard to resist.
Then don't.
Malibu High, where the most important subject is physical education.
How are you, Miss Bentley?
The best, sir. I need extra help, Mr. Mooney. I mean personal help. Couldn't we get together after school?
From history to physics.
The next report cards are about to come out. I want you to know what grade I expect.
About your grades, Miss Bentley. Truly remarkable.
From botany to driver's ed.
What grade do you expect?
An A.
All A's in all of your classes except Miss Damon's English class?
This is the story of a schoolgirl named Kim.
I don't understand. You never seem to study anymore.
Relax, Mr. Elmhurst. Enjoy the view.
Who was the best in her class? Malibu High.
And you have to respect the exploitation hustle, because the title and the poster have nothing to do with the actual film.
Right. It's like, it's so misleading, because it
looks
like
it should be a teen comedy.
It looks like it's going to be like a lighthearted high school teen sex comedy romp. And then you start watching and you're like, wait a second, what is going on here? But, it's like kind of like a cool, genre mixer type thing, where it's like, it's a little bit of this, a little bit of that. But the girl.
The impression that I got was like a youth scare film from hell.
Yeah,
after it is so special, made by a pornographer.
But I mean, it's like, I just love how it it says it's, you think it's going to be one thing, then it goes in the opposite direction, but the girl that stars as Kim, Jill Lansing, she never did another movie after this. So it's like, this is like her sole credit, for her film career. So it was pretty crazy. But she's really seductive, and then she's kind of bitchy too, which is she's really interesting, this actress. But the film starts with her waking up like every other teenager. She lights a cigarette, and she has some oatmeal as her mother nags her, and you can tell right away that Kim is really rebellious and something is off with her. You don't really know what's going on.
Is there anyone in the film that Kim is nice to?
No, I mean she's nice to I guess she's nice to the guys that she sleeps with and stuff like that. But, it's just
like she has the whole film. She's such a snarling little brat.
She has such an attitude, the biggest attitude. So then she goes to school. We see her daily routine. She goes to school. She's flunking every class. Her boyfriend's dumped her for another girl. She's basically sick of her life. And then she's totally losing across the board. And then one night while she's getting wasted at her friend's house, Kim decides to turn her life around. but she's not going to study harder, be kinder to others. She's going to get better grades by sleeping with the teachers and become a prostitute. Cut to her having sex with every guy in town. So to celebrate, she gets a new sports car and things are going well for her. Then she meets a guy that offers her a more lucrative position, not as a madam, but as an assassin. So he wants her to take out all the competition in town. So that's the kind of movie we're dealing with. It goes from Malibu High to La Femme Nikita. So Kim is hopping in and out of bed with men. She's like doing hits. She's punching her boyfriend's girlfriend in the face. It's like just all over. It's just a crazy movie. It's just, you know, it was just one of those films where you're watching, you're like, you don't know what the hell is going to happen. It's just the best. I just loved it. It was, and this girl, Kim, she's just such a, like, she's kind of like a magnetic character. I don't know. I just thought I liked her style a lot.
I mean, I never thought I would say this, but this movie by association made me appreciate Hitchhike to Hell more.
Yeah. The same director. I don't think I've seen it. Was it by the same guy?
Yeah.
Oh, really? Okay. I didn't see that one.
Yeah. The last movie he made after Malibu High was called Hitchhike to Hell.
It was after Malibu High? Okay. I didn't know that.
I never thought I would appreciate that movie more, but seeing how kind of disjointed this film is, he actually did learn something between movies. So good job.
I just really thought it was good.
Kim is such an unlikable character.
Yeah, she is.
And
it makes you like
remotely pleasant towards. Like, I don't know how she has a friend. I don't know how she has a boyfriend.
Yeah, I don't know. She's just such a sour pill, sour patch.
I kind of feel like maybe that she should have been slightly less obnoxious because things happen to her, it's basically of her own design and it's hard to feel sorry for her at all.
It's like she's basically on the path to hell, like from the very beginning of the movie. She's just not like, you know, she's not playing by any rules at all. And it's just,
she's not very sympathetic. She's not playing by any rules.
She goes right off the rails.
It is absolutely gut bustingly hilarious how inappropriate the music cues are to anything that's going on screen in this movie. Yeah.
And this is like a little detail that I loved, but now I grew up watching the show, The People's Court on TV.
It's the same.
And the theme of the song is that, and they put the, and they, I guess they used, well, it's not, they didn't use it from that show. The show got it from this movie, I guess, because it was
it's a library cue. It's a stock cue.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's Alan Two's The Big One, I think it's called. That's the name of the track, instrumental. But if you know The People's Court, that's like the main theme of that is like in this movie. I just love that little like thing at the end.
And it was they're like having a climactic chase scene.
A little chase scene.
Up and downstairs.
Yeah, I just love that. It was just really good. But I just loved like the whole way like this movie, like you expect it to be like sort of like a, you know, like Pom Pom Girls or something like that, or like Van, you know, just one of those like more like lighthearted, like, you know, just kids like having a good time like type movie. And it's just like it totally like goes like a different direction. I just love
how instead it goes super grim, like cautionary tale youth scare.
Yeah, it is like that. It's just very much like that type. It's like, you know, like late 70s version of one of those stories.
Yeah, like honestly, if you swapped out the characters a little bit and put a square up on it, you know, this sort of stuff, you know, has been around forever.
From the 50s, it would be like a 50s, one of those 50s movies. But I'm trying to think of like which one it would be like. Like, it's like one of those like 50s, like, you know, juvenile delinquent type films. But it's like, I don't know what, I'm trying to think of which one it would be.
Gateway is drugs. So really, you're probably looking at something like maybe cocaine films.
But even like those 50s JD films, like, you know, those ones where like the, you know, the girls are like, you know, go off the rails.
What about maybe girl gang?
Teenage gang debs or something like that. It's you know what it's like. It's almost like Kim is like one of those like badass like girls in the girl gang movies, but she's like by herself. There's no other like gangsters around. She's like the only one.
I just think it's so funny that
that's like, what it's like.
It's just like, hey, you with the wizard van, aren't you the local pimp?
Like, yeah, it's like. And it's like, you know, she just like decides one day to like start being a prostitute and like just totally like go off the, you know, off the deep end with like all that stuff. I just thought it was hilarious.
Also, someone correct me if I'm wrong, but this is not in Malibu.
Yeah, I don't know where. I'm not sure if it was like, you know, it's not Malibu, but it's like.
It does not look like Malibu to me.
So that's another little thing. So if it's not Malibu, that's even funnier because it's not even in that place. So in that town, which is even funnier. But it's like,
I feel like this could have used like. if you're going to, being that it was kind of a youth scare film, I really wish there had been, normally you have the sanctimonious character who does all the right things and, you know, chastises the protagonist for their various misadventures.
Right.
And meanwhile, everyone who is having misadventures looks like they're having a lot more fun, but Kim really has fun. She's just bitter.
She's just bitter and kind of like, you know, she's like, she did look happy when she got her little white sports car, but then she like flipped off her boyfriend's girl, you know, the boyfriend and stuff after.
Yeah. The boyfriend and his new girlfriend.
I just thought that, like, but she was such a, I was just, and it makes you wonder like what happened to Jill Lansing? Like, where is she now? Like after.
I think she looked at this movie and was like, yeah, maybe acting is not for me.
I know. But I mean, oh man, that was funny. It was just a fun film though. I just.
When she switches pimps and he's like, you're obviously mean as shit. Why don't you try assassinating people? That made me laugh so hard.
You can be a hit woman for me.
Yes.
Yeah. I just thought it was just a really odd little, you know, kind of fun little movie. I remember the first time I watched it, I was like, wow, that was really good. I just really loved it. You know, it just hit me a certain way. I was just like, I was expecting it to be one thing and it was a total opposite of what I expected or something. But that's my number one pick.
And a good December was had by all.
Yeah.
I mean, it always is.
That was a lot of movies to watch. We watched like, I don't know how many I watched during the month, but I watched more than 31. I watched probably like 56 or something, I think. But that was a pretty good list. Our list was good. That was a good like batch of films.
I feel like we have a nice variety of stuff. There's something for everybody.
You got some older films, a little bit of 70s stuff, a little bit of 80s stuff.
Yeah, we've got a bunch of genres. We've got a bunch of eras.
They're all entertaining in their own weird way.
I mean, if you're listening to a 42nd Street Forever podcast, I'm going to assume you're at least somewhat amenable to odd films.
Yeah, you're going to have to be into these movies a little bit if you're even listening to the podcast.
Like, you know, why would you seek that out if your favorite movies are romantic comedies?
Right. I mean, if you're into like, you know, Harry Potter or something, you're not going to want to watch Malibu High. But did you have any Blu-ray picks at all or no?
As far as recent Blu-rays, I've been catching up on older releases a lot, but as far as something that came out relatively recently that you definitely should check out.
Yep.
Sorry, let me sip this coffee because I'm raspy.
I was wondering if you were like, okay over there.
Yeah, because I'm like, having a big sound like a
donut and coffee. I'm having some tea myself.
Okay. There we go. But okay, as far as Blu-ray home media releases that I think are pretty awesome.
Yep.
I was really, really impressed with the Arrow video.
Ariel.
Ariel, Little Mermaid video. With the Arrow video, Mill of the Stone Women.
Oh yeah, I heard of that. And I've seen I haven't seen the movie yet, but you said it was really good.
Kind of the halfway in between House of Wax and Eyes Without a Face.
Oh yeah.
If you like either of those, it's kind of sitting at the intersection of those two films.
Yeah, I'd like it.
But it's a very beautiful, very stylish film, and the restoration is just stunning.
Who directed that one?
I would have to look it up. I don't remember off the top of my head.
Okay.
But the restoration is absolutely stunning. The supplemental materials, we're talking essays, we're talking, you know, there's a full booklet, there's multiple commentaries. Like, it's an amazing package.
Sounds good.
I feel like it's a film that a lot of people haven't necessarily seen.
Yeah, I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it yet.
You know, if you kind of like gothic horrors, if you like Eyes Without a Face, if you like House of Wax, if you like...
Yeah, I liked it. I like those.
You know...
Yeah, I like those
too. Atmospheric type of horror.
Yeah.
It's an absolutely beautiful film. It's never looked better. I doubt it ever will. And the Arrow package has everything you could ever possibly want to know about it, including multiple versions, the different cuts for the international market.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good to me. Is that all you got?
And also Vinegar Syndrome's Flesh for Frankenstein, because you can watch it in 3D. And
that's awesome.
Has been impossible. There was nowhere to watch that film in 3D for a very long time. So the fact that...
Since the Grindhouse days, probably.
Pretty much. I don't know of any other releases that included the 3D print.
Well, that's awesome.
Again, they always do a good job with the restoration, but specifically having the 3D available is a revelation.
I still haven't seen any movies on 3D and Blu-ray yet. I have to get like some 3D movie. I don't know. Maybe I'll get that one. I don't know. But when I was growing up, like I saw 3D movies at the actual movies too, but then they'd have like stuff on TV, and we'd actually get, we'd go to like store 24 or 7-Eleven, and you'd get the 3D glasses, and then you'd bring them home and you'd watch the
movie. I don't remember this. It's something that happened, but I do not recall ever watching a film in 3D at home.
Yeah, I did. Cause I mean, if that was like in the early 80s when I was like a little kid, and we used to do that. So like, you know, you'd watch like, I don't know if they did Friday the 13th 3
on 3D. My parents were just cheap.
Yeah, but I mean, you were probably too young back, you know,
it might have been just, you know, we're not spending the money.
Yeah, it could have been, but I mean, that was like a cool little thing. So that's where I first, and I saw Jaws 3 in 3D, and that was like my least favorite Jaws film, actually. That was the first one I ever saw in 3D. I
mean, isn't that kind of everybody's least favorite Jaws film?
Yeah, it is. It's not good, but anyways, going off topic, but I mean, I'd love to see like that, something like on Blu-ray in 3D like that. That sounds awesome.
Also, I've got to shout out Vinegar Syndrome's customer service. Apparently when the discs were being pressed, some of them had a color balance issue. They corrected it without people even asking. So good job.
Oh yeah. That's awesome. Yeah, they do a good job at that place.
Well, they just were like, hey, we're going to send you another disc. We don't even know if yours is broken, but just in case it is, we're going to send you a replacement. Okay. Like that's amazing customer service.
Nice. That's awesome. Okay, so I did have a couple picks for mine. And
by all means.
The first one I picked was Stone, which is one of my favorite Ozploitation films. And it came out in 1974. It's like a big cult film now. It's about like a undercover cop that goes undercover with a cop that goes undercover with a motorcycle gang. And it's like, you know, they're trying to find, there's like some assassin that's trying to take out the gang and stuff. And he's like trying to help them, like, you know, stop the guy. And
Ozploitation is due for like a revival and appreciation.
Yeah. I mean, it's like one of my most favorite films though. And of those Ozploitation genre films that came out in the 70s and 80s, like, you know, it's just really an awesome movie. And, you know, several people that were in Mad Max are in it, like Hugh Keyes Byrne is in it. And he plays one of the biker gang, and Roger Ward is in it too. You notice like when you watch Ozploitation films, a lot of the same actors like would show up in a lot of the movies, like that type of thing. But
who put it out?
Severin, I think, did put it out, and they actually I got their DVD years ago, and this is like the new Blu-ray version of the movie. So yeah, definitely one I would recommend, or you know, I don't want to recommend it, but it's one of my favorites. So. I'm trying not to
recommend it.
I don't recommend it, but I love it. And then the other one I like a lot is Don't Go in the House, which is like a slasher film, but you know, the killer uses a flamethrower instead of a knife or a machete or something like that.
I mean, anytime you're dealing with a movie with don't in the title, you should know what to expect.
Yeah, Don't Go in the House. It's like one of my favorite. It's almost like I call it the main character is like, you know, it's sort of like set like at the end of the disco era. So there's like disco music and stuff. And I just like the whole vibe of the film. And I like, you know, the main character, it has like a little psycho in it, that type of thing with like, you know, the guy that's like, you know, has mother issues because she like used to like burn him up and stuff. And it was just like all this crazy stuff in the movie. And it's just one of my most favorite slasher films. So that's the other one I would pick. And that's about it, I think, for my Blu-rays.
Well, you know, we've got to give everyone a break having survived the sale season before, you know, recommending them a whole bunch of new stuff to buy. So there's
true. Yeah, that's true. They've spent so much money for Christmas and stuff. So this will be like, you know, down the road when you get some money left again, you can pick some movies up. But I also want to do like, before we close the show, I was going to do the, what was playing on the Deuce on this day.
Yeah, sure.
You know that thing? So on this day in 1981, I'll tell you what was playing on 42nd Street at the Grindhouses. So at the Victory Theater, there was Hot Skin and Hard Candy. I don't know, like I've never seen either of those, but those sound fun. at the Lyric Theater, Scanners and Confessions of a Police Captain. At Times Square, Challenge of the Dragon and Snake Fist versus the Dragon. At the Selwyn, Death Rage and Kidnap Syndicate. Those are two Polizio movies. Italian crime movies.
My ticket money goes to the Lyric out of the option.
Yeah. Scanners and Confessions of a Police Captain.
Yeah.
And then New Amsterdam, Hangar 18 and Devil Times 5. That's a weird double feature.
That is a really odd.
I love Devil Times 5. I haven't seen Hangar 18. Yeah, I'm a big
fan
of that
one. In concept more than I like it in execution.
I don't know. I think it's hilarious, that movie. It's really funny. The kids that are like, you know, killing all the adults. and at the Sin of 42, Stir Crazy, and When a Stranger Calls. At the Liberty Theater, Sonny Chiba's Dragon Princess and Karate Warriors. At the Harris Theater, Holy Moses and Hollywood Nights. At the Empire, Hot, Cool, Vicious, and The Chinatown Kid and Kung Fu Punch of Death. And at the Anko, Raging Bull and Steel. Have you you've seen some of those movies, right?
Yes.
Like, I've seen, like, you know, a pretty good batch of them. I've seen, like,
out of Hollywood the options, my money goes to the lyric.
Yeah, that's a good, I like that one. Like Hollywood Nights, that's a funny movie. That's like sort of like an American Graffiti, like, you know, like with kids running around in the 50s or whatever it was, early 60s. And they're like, you know, doing pranks and stuff. And that was a fun movie.
I guess everybody gets a little nostalgic for like simpler times.
Yeah.
Because every generation has that. Like, it's usually comedies.
Right. And my, like, period piece. Right. Like when I was growing up, like Dazed and Confused was sort of like, even though that was the 70s, that was sort of like the Gen X, like sort of like American Graffiti, like movie for us, you know, even though it was like, you know, we were in the 90s type thing.
Well, think about it. The people who were coming of age then, that would have been like their childhood.
Right. Right.
Those colored glasses.
Right. And what other movies? I've seen several other ones. I've seen Scanners. I haven't seen Confessions of a Police Captain yet, though.
I haven't either, but, you know, it's one of two things.
I love Scanners.
It's
though.
Either a cheap action movie or it's a good sex film. And I'm down for both of those.
Yeah, I don't think it's not a sex thing. It's more of like a like an Italian, like, you know, cop movie like type thing. That's what that one is. I forget who directed it, if it was Damiano Damiani. It was one of those Italian directors, though. But and then Death Rage, I've seen that. I saw that once. Kidnap Syndicate, I haven't seen that one yet. Those are two like Italian crime films. And When a Stranger Calls, is that the one with Carol Kane? I can't remember.
Yes, When a Stranger Calls is Carol Kane, which is a great film.
Yeah, that is a good one.
It's amazing.
And Stir Crazy, I've seen that one. That's Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder. Yep.
It's fine. Like, it's a little bit broad in terms of comedy for my taste, but I don't dislike it.
Yep. And then Sonny Chiba's Dragon Princess. I haven't seen those two, Dragon Princess and Karate Warriors.
I'm down for anything that involves Sonny Chiba.
Yeah, I love Sonny Chiba, but those are two of the ones I haven't seen. I love the Street Fighters and, like, you know, all those ones, but, and then I have seen Hot, Cool and Vicious and Chinatown Kid. I don't think I've seen Kung Fu Punch of Death, though.
That, and, you know, it's not like we cross-reference for what these might be retitlings of. Like, I'm guessing the first two, obviously, like
Kung Fu films,
erotic films on the bill were probably retitles of something, but I just don't have that information in front of me.
And Raging Bull, you've probably seen that one.
Yes.
And we've both seen that one. So that's what was playing on the Deuce on January 16th, 1981. So I guess that wraps up the show.
Cool beans. Thank you for having me back.
That was great to have you. Great to talk to you again. And we had a good time, like, you know, going through all those films and pretty good discussion with all those things.
Well, I mean, we had a lot of stuff to choose from because December was a lot of movies. But it's always a fun event. I do it every year. And, like, you know, day 1 through 16, I'm all like, everything's great. Day 17, I'm like, I'm in over my head.
I'm over my head.
31, I just cry.
I know. I know. It's really like, and I actually did pretty good. I was watching for the first half, I was watching like double features every night. Then, like, at the end, I started to get kind of slowed down a little bit.
I don't try to do double features or big elaborate swings because I can't, like, you know, I'm just like, okay, let's not get too big for your bridge.
I know. It's like, and plus you're like, you have a lot of work and you have to write a lot and stuff.
Yeah. So I have to, you know, I have to write everything else that's due. And then, you know,
you're a writing fiend at this point.
Every year it's a good time. I always look forward to it.
Yeah, it is
fun.
I'm
like carefully curating my list at like Thanksgiving.
I know. You really get detailed with your stuff. I'm trying to get better at doing that. Like, you know, keep a little, but you do, like, the thing is you do reviews of everything. I don't review every single movie I watch. So, cause that takes a lot of energy.
I figure it keeps me accountable.
And also it's good for you, like, because you're a writer anyway. So it's like, it kind of like keeps you, like, you know, in the flow of, you know what I mean? What you do.
Yeah. I mean, that's, it keeps me accountable. It helps me, you know, finally get some of my watch list down.
Yeah. It's good. I mean, it's awesome to do that. But what was I going to say? But every year, like, you know, I don't know if you do like the other months, like I'll do like November and then I'll do like the October horror month.
No, I just can't sustain it. With everything else that I have to do, like,
yeah, right. you're already doing that stuff anyways, in a way, you know what I mean? You're already doing
it. Like with everything else I have floating around. Usually like December is a quiet month for me. So I have time to take on like a theme.
Yeah, it is good. I just wish there was more like I've seen so many movies now. I just wish there was like, but I mean, I suppose like, you know, what happens is like, I've watched so many, you know, I've been went into these movies for like years and years. So it's like, you've kind of seen a lot of stuff, but there, you know, I'm saying that, but then I've already discovered like some new films that I haven't seen yet. So it's like, I guess that happens every year.
If somebody recommends, like I have bookmarks.
Yeah. It's like, I guess it happens every year with that. So
yeah. I have bookmarks from everybody who participated of things that looked interesting that I hadn't seen. And I mean, there's always more to see.
Yeah. But I'm just glad that you liked the ones that I picked. Most of the ones I picked, you were like, oh, I like that one. Cause you're kind of picky.
I was like, yes, Siege. Hell yeah. I enjoyed Gordon's War a lot. Yeah. Malibu High was a mess, but I was entertained by the messiness of it.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, you know, one of those all over the place type movies.
Yes. And I mean, you're watching an exploitation film. Some of them are going to be all over the place.
Especially those Crown International ones.
Anything with Robert Forster, we're down. That, and like I said, the score for Walking the Edge fucking slapped.
Yeah. That was awesome. Yeah. It was like, I can't remember. I don't know who did the music for it, but I mean,
I don't know. It was not anyone that I like recognized the name of, but cocaine was a musical genre.
Cocaine. Yeah, I know. I mean, that's like back then in that, at that time period, it's like they always had that type of like crazy score. But so that was a good show. So, okay, so we'll close out. I'll say thanks to everybody for listening. This is Pete Roberts, 42nd Street Forever. We'll see you in the new year. Thanks, Gigi. We'll talk to you soon. Take care.